Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 8.
Okay, first, a bit of context. Bayou has just managed to get Kin Zong approved as his study buddy by Grandmother Jia.
Right.
So the family's busy. Wang Shif, Feng Ji, she's managing this big opera event for Grandmother Jia. The whole estate is buzzing.
He should be busy with that, probably. But of course, Bayou. He's not interested in being busy in that conventional way his father expects.
Not at all.
So he decides to visit Bao Chai. And the thing about his route, it seems really calculated. He doesn't just walk over there.
No, he deliberately avoids the main road.
Why? To avoid other matters, it says? Or maybe bumping into his father, who's napping in his study, the Meng Po Zai.
Right. And that decision, taking the long way around Rao Yung Lu, as the text says, that tells you so much about Bayou.
Yeah.
He's fundamentally trying to escape the rigid structures, the potential scolding from his father, the authority he's supposed to inherit eventually.
So his trip to Pear Fragrance Court, Lixiang Yun, it becomes this kind of walk through the entire social ladder of the estate.
Exactly, a social gauntlet. And he runs into two groups, back to back, that are just polar opposites.
Okay, who first?
First, you get the, let's call them the fawning literati, the clean guests, Ginkei Zhangguang, Zhang Guang, and Dan Kinrin.
Ah, the hangers-on.
Totally. They are just dripping with deference, practically falling over him, embracing him, holding his waist, his hand, calling him my bodhisattva brother.
Wow. Bodhisattva brother, that's intense flattery.
It shows how much they depend on the Jia family, right?
Yeah.
They need to constantly stroke the heir's ego. It's pure performance.
It really is. But then, like you said, it flips immediately.
Instantly. He runs straight into the practical guys, the seven headmen standing at attention. These are the managers, the bureaucratic engine.
The real power structure, in a way.
Yeah, the nuts and bolts. The head of the silver treasury, Wuxin Deng, head of the granary, De Liang. These guys.
And no flattery here, I bet.
Nope. Just, business. Transactional recognition. They're keeping the massive household running.
And there's that one lovely detail with the comprador, Qian Hua.
Oh, yeah. That's great.
He hasn't seen Bayou for a while, so he does the full formal bow, the d'incriminer. Deep respect.
And Bayou's reaction is so telling. He doesn't just, nod it off. He smiles, gently raises him up.
It shows that kindness under the surface, right? He kind of rejects that excessive formality the other guys were laying on so thick.
Exactly. And even the compliments are different. The regular staff, they compliment his calligraphy.
His dofonger, the big square posters, they say his writing's getting better.
Which is such a personal, specific compliment. It acknowledges his sort of softer skills, not managing granaries, but art.
So he navigates the flatterers, the managers, the staff, using a mix of his status, but also genuine charm.
He does. He manages to sneak through the whole apparatus of the family's public life.
Just to get to his cousin's quiet room.
Yeah. And the whole atmosphere is about to change dramatically.
Okay. So after all that,
that
social navigation, the energy just shifts completely when Bayou gets to Bao Chai's place.
Oh, absolutely. It goes from that bustling hierarchy to something really quiet, contained, almost like a retreat.
Yeah, monastic is a good word.
It's deliberate. First, he sees Aunt Sue sewing, doing her zanzi, and Bao Chai herself is tucked away in the inner room, the Lijian.
And it's described as warmer in there.
Warmer, yeah. And separated by this curtain, a half-old red silk soft curtain, Hong Chao Ruk Lin Lian, that detail, half-old. It's key. Even the curtain is modest, understated.
And that modesty just defines Bao Chai herself, doesn't it? The text really focuses on her appearance, but in a way that emphasizes naturalness, restraint.
Totally. No fancy jewelry, no elaborate hairdo. Her hair bun is just naturally glossy black Seihai Yugong de Mer.
And her clothes.
Half new, half old, it says explicitly. Hmm. Not luxurious. Rose purple vest lined with rat fur maybe, an onion yellow silk skirt. Nothing ostentatious. She's the total opposite of flashy.
She's got that kind of effortless beauty. The line is beautiful. Lips unpainted are red. Brows undrawn are jade green.
Exactly. She embodies that sort of controlled, naturally perfect, ideal Confucian lady.
Which leads to how the author sums up her whole persona, right?
She's described as, rarely speaks, people call her hiding her foolishness. Kang Yu, content with the moment, calls herself clumsy, Shouzhu.
Okay, hiding her foolishness, Kang Yu, that's fascinating. Because Everything else suggests she's actually really smart, well-read.
She is.
So why emphasize the Kanyu? Is it like a genuine flaw, or is it more about the societal pressure on women than, you know, to downplay their intelligence?
I think it's really both. It's her strategy for navigating that society, and it's also a reflection of the constraints on her.
Makes sense.
To be that perfect potential bride, she has to seem compliant, modest. She can't make waves. So this contained perfection, it's like her armor.
And then Bayou walks in. The contrast is just bam.
Oh, it's stark. He's like a walking treasure chest, wearing his wealth, his status, literally on his body.
The purple gold crown with treasure, the gold forehead band with the dragons.
The fancy white fox fur-lined jacket.
He's just dripping with status. Everything Bao Chai's setting and clothes deliberately avoid.
He is the spectacle. She is the restraint.
Ah.
But what they're about to find out is that despite all these outward differences, they're connected by something much older, more powerful
than fashion or family money.
Exactly. Something mystical.
So the mood shifts again, right? From social observation to destiny. When Bao Chai finally asks to see the famous stone Bao Yu was born with.
Yes. This is the heart of it. The moment the personal story connects to the big myth.
And he just takes it off right away.
Immediately.
Yeah.
And the description they give, it's important for understanding its divine origin. Big as a sparrow's egg, bright as glorious rosy clouds, glowing and smooth as cream.
Sounds pretty magical.
It is. And the text confirms this is the stubborn stone, the Wan Chi, from Kinging Peak, the divine piece that kicks off the whole novel.
Right, the origin story. And there's that funny little meta commentary.
Oh, yeah, the author winking at us.
Saying the real stone was tiny, small enough for a baby, but the drawing in the book is bigger so we don't get great eye strain.
Huh, yeah, that's a nice touch. A little reminder that we're reading a story, a myth designed for us.
But its power isn't just storybook stuff. The inscription on the front, it basically dictates Bayou's life path, doesn't it?
It really does. It reads, Adisho Shi Ma Wang Xian Shao Heng Te.
Okay, translate that for us.
Never lose, never forget. Immortal life, lasting prosperity.
Wow. That sounds like a divine command, you know. Remember who you are, where you came from, aim for eternity.
It's a mandate, yeah. You're divine. Remember it. Live up to it. And the back reinforces that. It lists these three specific magical powers.
What are they?
One, drive out evil spirits. Two, cure old grudges or sicknesses. And three, no misfortune and fortune.
So it's literally like a divine toolkit for life on Earth, a protection charm.
Exactly. A user manual for his destiny.
Okay, so Bao Chai is holding this amazing thing, reading the words Mo Shi Mo Wang Xin Shu Heng Chang, and then her maid, Yinger, speaks up.
Yinger, the lowest status person in the room, delivers the biggest bombshell.
Classic.
It's the huge aha moment. Yinger says, hey, my mistress's necklace has words that sound just like that, like they match.
And Bao Chai tries to downplay it.
Oh, yeah. She tries to brush it off, plays that modest role again. Oh, it's just some lucky phrases a monk gave me ages ago. Says she had them put on her gold Yingluo locket because he told her to.
But Bao Yu's not having it. He's obsessed with his stone, right?
Totally. He insists. He wants to see it. And the text specifies the locket came from the lame monk, Latu Heshong.
Ah, that recurring character, the messenger from the divine world.
The very same. And the monk insisted the words had to be engraved on gold.
Okay, so what does her locket say? The golden prophecy.
It reads, Ibuli Wuhi Fanglin Yinji. What does that mean? Never separate, never abandon, young years forever continue.
Whoa, okay, put those together.
The symmetry is incredible, isn't it?
Yes.
Bayou's never lose, never forget is perfectly mirrored by Bao Chai's never separate, never abandon.
It's a perfect pair.
Bayou sees it immediately. He says, they're truly you do we a pair. So this casual visit, this sick call.
Yeah.
It just confirmed this preordained connection.
A divine contract, basically.
Exactly. Linking Bao Yu and Bao Chai, forcing them together in a way that, mythically, they just can't escape. The intrigue starts almost immediately. The second Bao Yu arrives, it's about a scent.
Yes. He notices this very particular fragrance coming from Bao Chai. The text calls it a chilling, sweet, subtle fragrance.
That's quite specific.
Yeah.
Chilling and sweet.
Mm-hmm. And right away, this tiny detail tells you so much about Bao Chai. Bao Yu, naturally curious, asks if she's wearing perfume.
And her reaction. She completely dismisses the idea. So she finds perfumes sort of frivolous, even saying they make clothes smell smoky and scorched.
Wow. Okay, so that's her character defined partly by rejection, right? She's immediately set apart from maybe the more typical perfumed ladies of the aristocracy.
Exactly. She's practical. down to earth in a way. So if it's not perfume, Bayou wonders, what is that scent?
And the answer is key.
It really shifts your view of her. The scent is from a medicinal pill she took that morning.
Ah, so it's about health, not vanity.
Precisely. Internal balance, well-being. It grounds her character instantly, making her seem quite mature compared to some others.
And Bayou, being Bayou, he's still got that childish streak despite his intelligence.
Oh, absolutely. His immediate reaction is, what pill is that? Can I have one to taste? He's fascinated by her, by this practical knowledge she embodies.
Which she has to gently push back on that impulse.
She does. Reminds him you don't just pop random pills. It establishes her early on as this sort of rational, caring voice, a role she plays constantly.
That voice of reason gets an immediate counterpoint, though, because just then, Lin Dayu arrives.
She does. And she makes quite the entrance, doesn't she? Walks right in and jokes, Ayo, I've come at a bad time.
Which is funny because, well, why would it be a bad time?
Bao Chai asks basically the same thing, but Dayu, with that famous quick wit of hers, she elaborates.
Right. This is where she lays out her little philosophy of visits.
Mm-hmm. She suggests that if people alternated their visits, kind of staggered them, the host's home would be perfectly balanced.
Neither too cold nor too noisy. I love that line.
It's brilliant. She's using humor, yes, but she's also making a pretty sharp comment on the delicate dance of high society life. You know, managing social obligations.
She's basically telling Aunt Shu, the host, I see how complex this is, but in a charming, witty way, turning politeness into social commentary.
Exactly. It's pure Dayu.
Well, speaking of balance shifting, the weather outside is changing. The sources mention sleet starting to fall. Snow beads, they call it.
And the cold brings us right to the next point of tension. The wine.
Ah, yes. The wine. How does it start?
It's quite cozy at first. Baoyu's admiring the setting, complimenting Aunt Shu on her homemade snacks, pickled goose feet and duck tongues, specifically.
Sounds interesting.
Delicacies. And this prompts Aunt Shu, being a generous host, to offer him some of her best wine.
But that's where the rules kick in, hard.
Immediately. Before he can even take a sip, his wet nurse, Li Maomo or Nanny Lei, steps in, shuts it down.
Why? Is she worried about him drinking?
Well, yes, but her main concern seems to be authority. She explicitly says, look, he can drink a whole jar over at the matriarch's place, but not here.
Why not?
Because she'll get in trouble. She references a time she was blamed, scolded for 2 whole days, just because some servant let him have one tiny mouthful while she wasn't looking.
Okay, so this is crucial for listeners to grasp. The nanny's fear isn't primarily about Bayou getting tipsy.
Right. It's about protecting herself from the ultimate power back home. The Dowager Matriarch. It's all about the hierarchy, the systemic pressure.
Does she give any other reason?
She does add a secondary point, warning that Bayou gets a bit willful, the text says, Nongsing when he drinks, trying to enforce the Jia family rules, even in Aunt Shu's house.
Aunt Shu isn't having it.
Not really.
Mm.
As the host and his aunt, she sort of waves away the nanny's concerns, said, don't worry, I won't let him drink too much, and crucially, I'll take the blame if the matriarch asks.
Taking responsibility, that's key.
Mm-hmm. She even offers the nanny some wine, too, maybe to smooth things over. Nanny Lai backs off, reluctantly. So, crisis number one averted.
Yeah.
For now.
But the wine issue isn't settled. Bayou creates a new problem himself.
He does. Having won the right to have wine, he now insists he only likes it served cold.
Which, in the sleet, sounds chilly.
And this is where Bao Shai steps back in, again, acting as that protective figure, but her authority comes from a totally different place than the nanny's fear.
How does she approach it?
It's fascinating. She uses knowledge, specifically medical or health knowledge, as a form of gentle guidance. She jumps in right away with this practical advice. She argues that hot wine, well, it disperses quickly through your system. That's okay.
But cold wine?
Cold wine, she says, congeals inside you. It solidifies, basically.
Right, so it forces your body, your internal organs, the wuzang, to work extra hard just to warm it up again, which causes harm, puts stress on your system.
Exactly. It's such logical counsel.
Right.
Compare that to Nanny Li, who used threats and rules.
Mm-hmm.
Bao Chai uses undeniable reasoning based on health. She's empowering him to make a better choice.
And how does Bayou react to this? Does he argue?
Not at all. He's immediately persuaded by the logic. He just puts the cold cup down and asks for it to be warmed. No fuss.
Yeah, it really shows the kind of sway Bao Chai has over him, doesn't it? An authority built on pure reason and genuine care.
It's quite unique. And that influence is needed because guess who's back after Bayou's had 3 cups of warm wine?
Oh, no, Ninny Lee again.
You got it. Round two. You just can't escape the rules and regulations of that household.
What's her angle this time?
She pulls out the biggest gun. His father. She warns him. Careful now. Your father is home. He might decide to check up on your studies.
Ah, the Laoi, the ultimate patriarchal authority. That threat would loom large.
It absolutely does. Yeah. The text says Bayou's heart feels greatly ill at ease. He slowly puts his cup down again. The fear of his father's disapproval just deflates him.
But just as he's about to give in, Dayu steps up.
And she doesn't just offer a mild defense. Oh, no. She goes on the attack, tells Bayou to ignore the old creature.
The creature. That's harsh.
It is. And her defense is incredibly pointed. She turns social rules back on the nanny. She implies that Nanny lies being so cautious because she secretly thinks Aunt Shu's house is somehow unsuitable, that they're outside people.
Whoa. Okay, let's pause there. Calling them outside people, Wei Ren, that's a serious implication.
It's huge. Dayu is basically accusing the nanny of disrespecting the hosts, suggesting she doesn't trust Aunt Chu's family to provide a safe, proper environment for Bayou. It's a direct hit on their social standing, their honor.
No wonder Nanny Lai gets flustered.
Completely. She says Dayu's words are sharper than a knife, and it shows how Dayu uses her wit not just for amusement, but as a real weapon for protection, for affection. Sharp words can be powerful.
Okay, things are getting really heated now. Who diffuses this?
Bao Chai steps in again. The ultimate peacemaker. But this time, she doesn't use logic.
What does she do?
She uses touch. Physical closeness. She playfully pinches Dayu's cheek.
Oh.
And she says something like, Dayu's mouth is so sharp, you don't know whether to hate it or love it.
That's brilliant. It completely changes the dynamic.
Instantly. It breaks the tension, shifts the focus from this hierarchy clash back to the intimate, playful bond between the cousins. It softens Dayu's sharp edge with affection.
And Aunt Xiu, what's her final move?
She sees Bayou's spirits are lifting, thanks to Bao Chai and Dayu. So she makes a final call. She insists he stay for dinner, jizzes down on promising to protect him from his father, and crucially, orders more hot wine to be brought.
Radical hospitality is the solution.
Exactly. Using warmth and generosity to just banish that cloud of anxiety and authority.
Okay, so after all that drama, he does stay for dinner.
He does. He eventually stops drinking, has a pretty substantial meal. The text even mentions two bowls of sour bamboo shoot and chicken skin soup, plus some congee. Then, as the sleep keeps coming down, he and Dayu get ready to leave.
And this departure, it contains another really significant moment, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. For me, it's maybe the most intimate and telling moment of the whole visit. It really crystallizes the Bayou-Dayu relationship in just a few actions.
And it all revolves around a hat.
It does. A servant tries to put Bayou's big red felt rain hat on him, but the servant fumbles it.
And Bayou, probably still a bit keyed up from the Nanny Lai encounters.
He snaps. Calls the servant a clumsy thing and tries to sort out the complicated hat himself.
But he can't manage it.
Well, before he really struggles, Dayu steps in, right up close, and takes over.
And this isn't just putting a hat on someone.
No, no. This is about deep, intimate care. The details the text gives us here are incredibly specific, and they matter hugely.
Tell us. What does she do?
Okay, so she gently sorts out his hairpiece, his top knot, the Shu Fa Guan. Then she carefully tucks the brim of the big rain hat under his decorative forehead band, the Mo.
Ah, so it sits correctly.
Precisely. And then, the final touch. She makes sure the large walnut-sized red silk tassel, the Jiangrong Zaining, is positioned just right so it stands up properly and quivers slightly. Chanwai.
Wow. That level of detail, arranging his hair, his specific headwear.
It's a ritual of closeness. This isn't something just anyone would do. By tending to his appearance, his hair, his clothes so meticulously, Dayu is performing an act of deep affection and trust. It's about its presentation, his dignity, handled by someone incredibly intimate.
That little quivering tassel says more than a whole love poem, almost.
I think so, yeah. It speaks volumes about their bond, their unspoken connection.
And yet, even after that incredibly personal moment, the formalities still need to be observed.
Right. Aunt Xiu, ever mindful of propriety and safety, insists on sending two older serving women to escort Bayou and Dayu home through the snow. Rules are rules, even after intimacy.
Jiu Baoyu coming home. He's been at a relative's place, had way too much wine, and he basically stumbles back to his own rooms, Jiang Yin Xuan, totally drunk.
Mm.
And the second he walks in, things just immediately go off the rails.
It's such a perfect little case study right from the start. It shows you the power dynamics instantly. You've got Bao Yu, the spoiled young master,
right,
totally entitled, plus he's drunk, so he's volatile, and he crashes right into this conflict with a servant who kind of feels untouchable because of her history.
Liani Saiet, the wet nurse.
Exactly. And that explosion, it just reveals all this pent-up friction that's usually kept under wraps in the household. It's an uncensored look.
So the first thing he does is ask where she is, his old wet nurse, Lionitzi. And his response when she's not immediately there is, well, it's incredibly harsh. He says something like, she's more comfortable than the elder matriarch herself. Why even ask? Maybe I'd live longer without her.
That bitterness, it comes from her specific role. The wet nurse, you know, even long after the child she nursed is grown, she keeps this kind of leverage.
Because she fed him?
Yes, she fed him. She cared for him in infancy. And that creates this bond, or at least this historical claim. And it often translates into, well, status and privileges that she can exploit, maybe protecting her own family, maybe pushing other servants around.
Okay.
So Bayi's the master, technically, but he can't just, you know, fire her easily or ignore her claims. She's like this built-in annoyance he can't get rid of.
So that resentment is always simmering. How does it actually boil over here? The text gives us these two really concrete complaints, both about, interestingly, food and drink. What did Lionitzi actually do?
Well, she took things he'd specifically set aside for his maids.
Mm.
First, these tofu skin buns. Bayu knew they were King Wen's favorite, one of his maids, and he saved a plate just for her.
Okay.
Lionitzi just waltzed in and took them for her grandson. Apparently told the other servants Bayu wouldn't necessarily eat them anyway.
Wow. So directly undermining his authority, his personal wishes.
Completely. It's her asserting her own domestic power right over his stuff. And then there's the tea.
Right, the maple dew tea. This seems even more pointed because it's about taste, about refinement. Why was that specific tea such a big deal?
Well, Bayu makes a point about it. He says this particular reserve tea is only really excellent after the third or fourth brewing. He's setting himself up as this connoisseur, right? But these exacting standards. And Lionitzi, she just drank it. She insisted on tasting the reserve and then finished it off. Zero respect for his specific instructions or the fact that it was, you know, a valuable reserve.
She's basically saying her comfort matters more than his refined taste.
Exactly. She's telling him, and maybe everyone else listening, my privilege trumps your preferences.
And that's the breaking point. Losing the tea pushes him over the edge. He takes the cup he's holding. Another maid just brought him a fresh one and just throws it down.
Smashes it.
Smashes it to pieces, tea everywhere. And then he declares he's going to demand Lionitzi be banished. Immediately. Kicked out. Says he doesn't need her milk or her presence anymore.
And here you see the raw power of the young master unleashed. He can, you know, with just a word, potentially ruin someone.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when he's drunk. That's almost his excuse. But the way the maids handle it is brilliant. Shirin, his main attendant.
She was pretending to sleep.
Yeah, just waiting it out, probably trying to gauge the right moment.
Mm-hmm.
And she jumps in.
But she doesn't defend Lionitzi, which is interesting. She uses this, like, reverse psychology. What does she do?
She totally agrees with him. Says, you're right. Banish her. If she's causing trouble, get rid of her.
Okay.
In fact, she adds, if you really want peace and quiet, you should banish me and all the rest of us too. Right now, we'll all happily pack our bags.
So she calls his bluff, basically. Emotional blackmail, almost.
It's precisely that. She plays on how much he actually relies on them, on their care, their loyalty, faced with losing everyone who actually looks after him properly.
He'd be lost.
Completely. And just like that, Bayu shuts down. He goes silent. So his immense power, it's checked by his equally immense need for their very specific kind of care.
It's fascinating how that intense anger, all that stuff about status and resentment, it just sort of evaporates once he's alone with the people he actually likes. The mood shifts completely.
Yeah, the text pulls back immediately to show you his inner world, which is quite different. We go from that public explosion of hierarchy to these really quiet, intimate moments.
Like with King Wen. He asks her about the sign he wrote for his pavilion, the character's Janyun Swan.
Right. And she tells him this little story. She climbed up herself to hang the plaque.
Because she didn't trust anyone else to do it right.
Exactly. And she says her hands got frozen doing it. So what does Bayu do?
He takes her hands in his to warm them up.
Yeah. He holds her hands, warms them with his own heat. And that's, yeah. I mean, that's a crucial little detail. It's really not typical master-servant behavior.
No.
It shows this level of physical closeness, emotional connection that really defines Bayu's relationship with his closest maids, The lines are blurred.
And we see that warmth with family, too, right? When his cousin Dayu stops by, she compliments his calligraphy.
And he teases her, asking if she's just buttering him up to get him to write her a plaque. It's light, it's easy, no status games there.
None at all.
And then there's that final little act before he falls asleep. Sharon again.
What does she do?
After she gets the drunken Bayou settled in bed, she carefully takes off his spiritual jade. You know, that vital talisman he always wears.
The one that's tied to his fate.
Right. And she wraps it in her own handkerchief and tucks it under his bedding. Just so the jade won't feel cold against his neck when he eventually wakes up.
That's, wow. Such a small thing, but it says so much.
It really does. It summarizes the whole dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
This household operates on these huge hierarchical tensions, the potential for explosions like the teacup incident.
Mm.
But it's held together day to day by these incredibly personal, almost self-sacrificing acts of affection and care. The smashed cup versus the warmed hands, that contrast is Bayou's reality.
Okay, so that's the internal emotional world. But then, boom, the next morning, the scene shifts dramatically. We go from that personal chaos of Zheng Yunxuan to the very formal, structured world outside it.
Yeah, complete change of pace.
A new schoolmate arrives. Young Master Rong brings this boy, Qin Zong, to pay his respects.
And Bayou, who we know can be incredibly picky about who he spends time with.
Right.
No, he's instantly impressed with Qin Zong. The text notes his handsome appearance, his gentle demeanor. Bayou immediately decides, okay, this kid is worthy company for studying. That's a big deal coming from Bayou.
And the official family stamp of approval comes from Grandmother Jia, right? She keeps them for tea, for meals, gives Qin Zong presents.
Mm-hmm. Gives like a silk purse and, importantly, a golden kujing.
What does that symbolize?
Kujing is the god of literature and examinations. So a golden kujing, it represents this very auspicious idea, the union of the literary stars. It's basically the family, especially Grandmother Jia, putting their blessing on this educational partnership, signaling high hopes for Qin Zong's future.
But as always in this book, there's a story behind the story. We need to understand Qin Zong's background, especially his father, Qin Yu.
Absolutely. Qin Yai is a clerk of the Ministry of Works, and he's nearly 70. It's mentioned he only had Qin Zong quite late in life, past 50.
So this son represents everything to him.
He's the future. Qin Ye sees this chance for his son to study with the famous scholar Jia Daidai at the Jia family school as the absolute key. The path to success, fame, security for the whole family rests on this.
But there's a catch, a big one, the money.
A huge one. The source material is really blunt about it. It says Qin Ye is shamefully strapped for cash, Huan Nanxusei. He's terrified of the Jia family's rich eyes, you know, their potential judgment or scorn, because he's not wealthy. And just to get Qin Zong in the door, he has to scrape together 24 taels of silver.
Just as an introductory gift. The Jiji only.
That's right. Just the entrance fee, essentially. 24 taels. For a man in his position, that's described as a truly painful sacrificial sum.
So let's put that side by side. We have Bayou, just hours before, smashing a valuable cup because his fancy tea wasn't brewed exactly right.
The third or fourth brewing, yeah.
And then we have Qin Zong's elderly father having to basically bankrupt himself, scraping together 24 taels just for the privilege of his son entering the Jia school. The difference in how money and opportunity function is just stark.
It couldn't be clearer. For Bayou, education is this thing he's supposed to do, maybe endures. For Qin Zong, it's everything. It's the family's lifeline. It shows you that even getting access to the Jia world, even just their school, requires serious social capital and, well, cold hard cash.